Alrighty, welcome. And here we go on the Mind Body Wellness webinar for the MMCP for January 2017. So we had received an email question, and that was about enzymes, in particular pancreatic versus plant-based enzymes. So we're going to start there, and as other questions or thoughts come up, please do type them into either the Q&A or the chat. So pancreatic versus plant-based enzymes, we're really going to be focusing on enzymes in general, especially the pancreatic versus plant-based. And the place to start with this is to say that most plant-based enzymes are proteases, and pancreatic enzymes are more commonly lipases and amylases. And there's, of course, some certain advantage intuitively in using pancreatic enzymes in terms of their structure being very similar to ours, but there's also a consideration for whether we're looking to have a person be able to best digest proteins, fats, or carbohydrates. So depending on if protein is an issue, obviously we have to also think about stomach acid. So we definitely first want to think stomach acid in relation to protein digestion. We want to be able to do a stomach acid protocol and make sure that that is adequate in their amount of stomach acid in order to be able to break down whole proteins into amino acid parts. So that's something that first and foremost needs to be addressed and considered with relation to protein digestion. But let's say we've done something about hydrochloric acid and they're still struggling a little more with proteins than with fats and carbohydrates. Well, in that case, we may be thinking more in the direction of plant-based enzymes because of that increased number of proteases. If a person, on the other hand, is having difficulty digesting fat, the first thing we want to think about, of course, is bile and gallbladder and liver function. And we may be looking at precursors to bile salts like taurine and glycine. We may be looking at cholagogues, herbs that can help stimulate the gallbladder contractions. We may be looking at replacement ox bile. Those things are going to be first and foremost. But again, in relation to enzymes, we may be thinking pancreatic a little more so than plant in cases of fat and carbohydrate digestion, whereas we may be thinking plant a little bit more in relation to protein digestion. So most commonly, because of the importance of addressing hydrochloric acid, stomach acid for and in relation to the protein issues, and because of addressing bile in relation to fat issues, yes, we also want to be looking at enzymes, but we most commonly, at least in our practice, do work with pancreatic enzymes because of the carbohydrate emphasis there, and carbohydrates being less impacted by stomach acid and bile. So in relation to carbohydrate digestion, that's something that we do consider frequently when we are looking at enzymes with food for the purpose of impacting and increasing digestion and digestive capacity. Now, it's a little bit of a different story if we are thinking about enzymes for reasons other than digestion. So we may be thinking about enzymes in relation to inflammation. Now, when we're thinking about enzymes in relation to inflammation, that's a little bit of a different story and a different purpose. many times we're thinking about enzymes, in that case, like bromelain, for example. And we know that bromelain, when taken away from meals, not with meals, but away from meals, can have an impact on reducing both histamine reactions, so sometimes used in histamine formulas, and also with helping reduce inflammation or inflammatory byproducts of histamine or other reactions. So if we're generally looking for inflammatory support, we may be looking a little more at plant-based enzymes like bromelain, quercetin, things like that. And one product that is sometimes used without food for purposes of inflammation is Wobenzyme. And Wobenzyme is a combination of several products in it, several different enzymes that are focused on the inflammatory part. And so that's something that we can consider as well as digestion. We can also think with enzymes about biofilms. So biofilm is, of course, becoming more of a hot topic. It's still young in its research. We still don't know exactly how much of a role biofilm plays, and there's not a lot of research comparing using a biofilm supplement versus not using a biofilm supplement together with antimicrobials or other protocols for things like SIBO or gut infections or chronic infections. But we do know that biofilm, there's definitely solid research that biofilm is a defense mechanism of pathogens in order to survive, especially when they feel under attack. So in theory, it sounds good. We need more research to see in practice how good or effective it is. But there are a variety of different approaches and ways to help with using enzymes and other substances to help break down biofilm. Enzymes are one of the most commonly used things. So natokinase is an example of an enzyme that's commonly used to break down biofilms. And another example of a multi-enzyme product that's used with biofilm is a product called Interphase or Interphase Plus, or two different products by the same company. The only real difference, I believe, is that Interphase Plus has EDTA in addition to enzymes, whereas Interphase is mostly just enzymes. So enzymes for biofilm are definitely coming onto the market and are being utilized by practitioners. So here we have enzymes for digestion, enzymes for inflammation, and enzymes for biofilms. So pancreatin is an enzyme that can help to reduce joint discomfort. And of course, that would be a pancreatic enzyme. Papain, I believe, is from fruit, a plant-based, and that's an anti-inflammatory. So again, that might be one good away from meals for that purpose. Trypsin can accelerate muscle repair and boost immunity. Bromelain, which I also already spoke about briefly, about its effect with inflammation. So this just shows that there's also, in addition to that inflammatory impact, there are also positive results in some cancer studies. So there's also a question here about lumbrokinase for breaking down biofilm and lauricidin for breaking down biofilm. So lumbrokinase comes from an earthworm, and that earthworm has been used in Chinese medicine for thousands of years. So Dilong is the Chinese name, and that is the whole earthworm, not just the enzyme derived from the earthworm. But traditionally and classically in Chinese medicine, earthworm is used for, in particular, lung issues and phlegm. And it helps break down phlegm. Now, if we think in the modern conventional understanding of what is biofilm, we can think that biofilm, well, it has a phlegm-like component because it's a protein matrix, we know, but it's kind of slimy in its, you know, it's sort of like if you take a glass of water and you fill that water halfway full and you leave that halfway full glass of water out for 4 or 5 days, and then you go to wash that glass, you empty out the water, well, what's left as a rim around where the top of the water was is a biofilm. That's a biofilm the bacteria make as that water sits out. And that gets a little bit hard to scrub off. It's sort of slimy at first, and gradually as it gets exposed to air, it can become harder. But we know there's this slimy, sludge-like sort of a sense to biofilm, at least in its early phases. So to break down phlegm, and the Chinese medicine understanding of phlegm has a very strong correlation with our modern contemporary understanding of biofilm in research. So it may have been that the Chinese doctors and Chinese medicine practitioners were on to biofilm before biofilm was a concept, and the concept that the ancients used to describe this similar phenomena was called phlegm. And one product they used was they took earthworms, and the Latin name for earthworms has that lumbro in it. And so lumbrokinase is an extract of the enzyme from earthworm for breaking down biofilm. So interesting history, and a great correlation. Whenever we see correlations between ancient wisdom and modern convention, it's a wonderful marriage that we can have, not only the contemporary research, which is fantastic, but limited in the sense of it being relatively new and not so time-tested, together with time-tested traditions that have been using herbs for thousands of years. So lumbrokinase, the experience that I have and that we have is a little bit more with using the full earthworm versus using just the lumbrokinase enzyme extract, but it is a fantastic herb, especially for asthma, is one of the number one uses, or impaired lung capacity for a variety of other reasons. But it very well may help with phlegm of all kinds and biofilm of all kinds. Then for lauricidin, yes, we do have experience with lauricidin, and we have seen the research on lauricidin with biofilm. And it is one reason why we use lauricidin, and we're always looking for products that have multiple uses. And if we only have one use, like only biofilm, then we're less likely to use a product than if we have two uses, like, for example, N-acetylcysteine has biofilm disruption and also is a precursor to glutathione. So if we want to improve someone's glutathione status and disrupt biofilm, we are much more likely to choose NAC versus choosing one biofilm supplement like Interphase and one supplement for glutathione, like a combo product of Amino Detox. That would be a fine way to do it, but because we're always encountering sort of hitting a threshold in terms of how many supplements we want to give people and how much people can afford and effectively do, we love it when we can get multiple things happening with one supplement. So with respect to lauricidin and biofilm breakdown, lauricidin is not an enzyme, but what it is it's monolaurin. And monolaurin is lauric acid we find naturally in coconut oil. And it's in the spectrum somewhere between medium chain and long chain triglycerides. And it has definite research that some of it converts into monolaurin. And monolaurin has a lot of antimicrobial impact research behind it, antiviral research behind it, antifungal research behind it, and antibiofilm research behind it. And so because there's been some research in specific with lauricidin and Lyme, and our practice deals with a lot of chronic infection in Lyme, we do use it, and we do see that it's a nice way to get at biofilm plus another function. And so let's say someone has SIBO. With SIBO, lauricidin can help to be an antimicrobial agent and a biofilm disruptor. So if we're dealing with something like SIBO, lauricidin might be a good choice, or if they're experiencing die-off effects, NAC might be a nice choice for a biofilm disruptor. So yes, we do use lauricidin as another option in the category of biofilm disruption. Thanks for that question. So Wobenzym has some research behind it too for a variety of things in addition just to inflammation. We see it in relation to anti-clotting. We see it having some antioxidant potentiation effects. We see there being a lowering of cholesterol in some cases. So it wouldn't be a number one go-to, but again, if we have high cholesterol and inflammation, we're looking to get them both, we might look at Wobenzym. Aids in rheumatoid arthritis, joint pain. So it's always nice to have some joint pain tools because a lot of people know to go to a health food store and get started with something like glucosamine and MSM. That's pretty common from at least our clients when they come in. Many of them have already gone that far. But so they're, you know, maybe have covered that base of getting a little bit of sulfur from MSM and getting some glucosamine because they've heard that's good for joints. So in order to take it to the next step, we want to first off get to root causes and figure out why the inflammation is there. But secondly, we might want to do some branch treatment. So if we think root branch and root is the root cause of the issue, branch, if we look at a tree, the roots give the tree the nourishment and really impact the end fruit. But the branches also have, you know, that would be more like the symptomatic expression. So we want to prune the branches and we want to nourish the roots of the tree. And so working on the symptoms are like pruning the branches, and working on the root is more like nourishing the roots with nutrients and things that the tree needs to grow more higher quality leaves and fruit. So with that metaphor, we may want to do another branch thing in addition to the MSM chondroitin or glucosamine type of supplements that people might already be on when we're dealing with joint pain, particularly rheumatoid arthritis joint pain, and Wobenzym may be helpful in those cases. Now, let's say we have specifically a lab marker for inflammation like hsCRP, which is a fantastic lab marker for inflammation. We like hsCRP better than regular CRP. CRP stands for C-reactive protein. HS stands for high sensitivity. So high sensitivity C-reactive protein is our choice for a general systemic inflammatory marker that's non-specific to a particular area. And hsCRP will tell us that there's inflammation, but not where that inflammation is. Could be in relation to RA joint pain, could be in relation to the cardiovascular system, could be in relation to a gut infection. We don't know. But we have a general marker, and that can act as a progress indicator as we go through treatment. So we want it to help to have us be indicating whether we're finding the root cause and resolving it, but we might also want to think about a thing or two that can directly help with lowering hsCRP. And our go-to things for that are curcumin in a choice form like Therakermin HP. And then also Wobenzym can be helpful too, especially if there's joint pain as well. And so we might be thinking about enzymes taken away from meals for that purpose. And then breaks down harmful proteins. We see with Wobenzym that makes sense with the proteases and plant-based enzymes. So if there's excessive harmful types of proteins, then we might be thinking about a plant-based enzyme away from meals in that case. Okay, switching gears now to a patient case. We are going to look at some labs, look at some things that are that we're dealing with in some of our really challenging cases in order to help you guys to be able to think through some things that you might sort of encounter that will go against what your average person's going to go through, so that you can be prepared for dealing with those challenging situations. So this is a 12-year-old female with severe Lyme disease. And this is a level of severity that is in the extreme category. So she is pretty much disabled. She's requiring care all of the time. and she's frequently, she's nowhere close to functioning, nowhere close to high level functioning, nowhere close to even being able to care for herself. So she's needing constant care and support. She gets Herxheimer reactions to just about everything, and she's highly sensitive to supplements. All of the supplement protocols have to be very, very carefully introduced at a very slow rate, and it's very difficult to tease out what's a reaction to a supplement and what's just a bad day, because some bad days involve severe reactivity, and there's a lot of ups and downs regardless of whether supplement protocols change. So this makes it very hard to hash out what is creating or causing a Herxheimer reaction, if it is indeed a Herxheimer reaction to a supplement, or if it's something that's just more of an up-down that's a part of the disease process. Insomnia is one of her big, big deals. She's got a lot of trouble falling asleep, staying asleep, is often awake until 4 a.m. And she's been through the ringer in terms of going to different doctors. Her family is so, so supportive and helps care for her, and is often very able to do a lot of different things to give her support, but also frustrated with the level of disability and the level of care required. And so it's a difficult situation. She's been to a lot of different Lyme doctors and other doctors, and so we're helping to do what we can for her. And here is one of her labs. So this is a Dutch adrenal lab, and this is the first page. And in this page, we see that her DHEAS status is actually fairly impressive for the level of severity of symptoms that she's got. So 141 still isn't quite optimally where we'd like to see it. We'd like to see it above 200, but it's in the upper half of the range. So we're feeling, you know, reasonable about that, and that that shouldn't be a huge indicator of anything too crazy in terms of what's going on for her. However, when we do look at the total cortisol metabolism here, and we see that metabolized cortisol is off the charts high, 10,657, whereas the high end of the range is 5,400. So she's off the charts high with metabolized cortisol. Well, now it's not such a mystery as to why she's not sleeping. But why then is her metabolized cortisol so high, off the charts high? So we can see here how this would be very correlated with her symptoms. We can see here how her insomnia and anxiety would be significantly impacted by this total metabolized cortisol level. And we see the same thing reflected in her free cortisol level as well. So her total free cortisol 24-hour sum is 438. And we would normally want to see that sum a little bit closer to between 80 to 185 is the range. So I'm going to annotate here and spotlight a little bit so you can see. So she's 438, which is off the charts high. 80 to 185 would be the 24-hour cortisol, free cortisol sum that we would expect in health. So this is a rare result. You're not going to see this very often, but if you do, we want you to understand that this could be, you could see it in a very difficult case. This may be with someone who's at the level of disability, though. So we see on waking, on waking and at night are the closest times to a normal range. But we see that morning and afternoon are very, very high. We also see that the cortisone levels are high as well, and the body is preferencing cortisol versus cortisone. And cortisol is more active in the body, so the preferencing of cortisol is probably also exacerbating symptoms. So we have a very significant situation here, which is going to be problematic, as we can see, for her symptom picture. What's the root cause? So besides having Lyme and other chronic infections, this patient was being prescribed cortisol. So we have to understand that cortisol in a prescription, it's going to, so there are three main prescription cortisol cortisol-like medications that are going to impact cortisol levels. One is hydrocortisone. That's going to be the closest to the, basically like a bioidentical to the cortisol made in the body. So hydrocortisone is our preference. If someone is prescribed cortisol, of course, our preference is that they're only prescribed it if they're low in their levels of cortisol. But our preference is that hydrocortisone, which is more like the bioidentical, is the one that's used. And so that's one thing that's prescribed, but unfortunately, it's not the most common thing that's prescribed. And in fact, it's the least common thing that's prescribed. Number two, the most prescribed one is prednisone. Prednisone is a steroid. It's used a lot and prescribed a lot in cases of autoimmune conditions like Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, and other especially when people are getting acute flares. Prednisone is often prescribed, and any other uses that people might have a steroid for, so anti-inflammatory uses as well as immune suppressive uses, are commonly used with prednisone. But adrenal insufficiency is used with prednisone. It's a little bit less common. And prednisone is about 4 to 5 times stronger than hydrocortisone, than our bioidentical in the body, and its half-life is longer. So it can really disrupt HPA activity and stop endogenous production much more, or reduce endogenous production much more significantly than hydrocortisone. So when we see prednisone prescribed, we have to consider its multifactorial exponential effects over the bioidentical cortisol and its increased half-life. And whenever someone comes off of that, we're going to see severe depressed HPA activity in almost every case. The third that's prescribed is dexamethasone. And dexamethasone isn't prescribed all that often, but sometimes it is. It is more than 10 times and some up to maybe 40 or 50 times as potent as cortisol in the body. So it is extreme in its level of corticosteroid activity, and its half-life is even longer than prednisone. So that is the one that most significantly can shut down endogenous production and is furthest away from the bioidentical cortisol in the body. So with this lab, just like we would be checking thyroid labs for people who are medicated with thyroid to check in and see how well that's doing, we see on this lab that the levels of cortisol were extreme and that the prescription cortisol may have been making the insomnia much, much worse and been one of the primary root causes behind her insomnia. So just something for you to be aware of and to check in with people about and to help to point people towards that those sorts of things might be, sometimes it's a substance. Sometimes it's something a person is taking or it's something that they're doing, and it's pretty simple and we don't necessarily need to, you know, if we hadn't asked good questions, we could have thrown supplements and labs all day at this one and not had an impact. So lesson learned there. Second patient. So with the second patient, this is someone who has had chronic sleep issues, and female, chronic sleep issues in her 50s, and she's had these sleep issues for years, but they've been worse since going through menopause. And hormones have been an issue as well. And so she complains of some hot flashes. They're not terrible, but the sleep issues are terrible. Occasionally, when she's sleeping, she'll get night sweats. There are gut issues. Bloating is an issue, and constipation is an issue. So those are things that have also been going on for years. And inflammation is an issue as well that she complains of, and that may be the cause of some of her back pain, which she also has chronically. Back pain isn't her primary complaint. The sleep is number one, and then the hormones and gut are the next couple. But she does have back pain, and there is inflammation, and she's also got swollen joints. So that's what we're working with as her main issues. And she, when we ran labs, what we found is we found mild small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. We were surprised not to see it more significant, but here is a good lesson in that even if a lab comes back mild, we may get really significant benefits from treatment, because her treatment quickly helped her to be free of bloating and to have regular bowel movements. So her digestive and gut issues went away fairly quickly with treating even the mild SIBO. So that's something to really keep in mind as you're doing these labs, is that you don't have to get a severe case. You don't have to get a really high elevation on a lab in order for people to get good results. In fact, sometimes we see that people with really high levels on a lab, once in a while, they're not that symptomatic. Usually they are, but once in a while they're not. And sometimes we see that it takes a lot more work and a lot longer, obviously, to help a person with high levels to feel significantly better. So in a certain sense, the mild SIBO here was great, because we started treating it. It responded beautifully, and she felt better very quickly. So with mild SIBO, and when people start to feel better very quickly, these people may be closer to the 4-week treatment time group, which is really nice when someone with 4 weeks of treatment can get better from a digestive issue that's been going on for years. Now, of course, we have to also then repair leaky gut, and we also have to prevent recurrence by working on the migrating motor complex if we believe that was part of the problem. Then we also saw that she had low free testosterone on her blood work, and she had high free T3. And so free T3, of course, is the free portion of thyroid hormone, and it is the more active and bioavailable portion of what has its activity in the cells. So it's the best indicator of overall thyroid activity in the cells. Now, if someone has insomnia, then what might increased thyroid activity do? Well, one symptom of overactive or hyperactive thyroid is insomnia, anxiety. And so it's no surprise here that with high free T3, we're thinking, okay, maybe we've found a part of the root cause for why there is some insomnia. So she was being medicated for thyroid, so we recommended that she speak with her prescribing physician for her thyroid medicine, bring that lab, and have a conversation about the dose to make sure that it's that there might not be an over medication contributing to her insomnia. Then she also had some dysglycemia. Her fasting glucose and her hemoglobin A1C were normal, and actually pretty good even from a functional perspective. her glycated serum protein was normal, but she did have high glycomark. Glycomark is the indicator for drop in blood sugar. So this is the valley in the blood sugar, the low in the blood sugar is a little too low. So what this indicates to us is that she's either not eating enough or she's skipping meals or taking too long between meals, or she's maybe not having enough carbohydrate if she's too low in carbohydrate. So those are the three main things that we're thinking in relation to that high glycomark. We're also considering adrenal insufficiency, because we do know that with low cortisol and dysregulated HPA activity on the low cortisol side of things, that there is potential for low blood sugar as well to be correlated with that. And we might look for a corroborating LDH marker on the blood to be low. And if lactodehydrogenase, which is an enzyme that's dependent on glycolysis, so it can be indirectly, so we see low LDH a lot. Low LDH isn't traditionally or conventionally looked at as a problem. High is more of the problem. But what we do see clinically is that it can be one indicator, together with glycomark, of low blood sugar, which is good to get an indicator of, because a lot of people with blood sugar drops and low blood sugar aren't necessarily going to have low fasting glucose. So just like looking at fasting insulin to see ahead of time, a little before glucose gets high, we can kind of see it coming. Well, with glycomark and LDH, we can kind of see low blood sugar coming, so before it's a big issue. So we had a conversation with her about the factors, and found out that she probably wasn't eating quite enough quantity. She was eating regularly enough, but not quite enough quantity, and perhaps not enough carbohydrate. Which, not enough carbohydrate can also be a problem for overall HPA axis status, and it can also impact thyroid conditions. And hypothyroid can be worse in some people with low-carb diets if they're too low-carb. So, because she's medicated for thyroid, we think, okay, well, she needs medication for thyroid, so there's some issue with why root causes bind, why thyroid is out of balance. So we're starting to get clues here about perhaps excessive low carbohydrates and or not eating enough. Now, not eating enough is more of an issue. I was surprised at how much of an issue not eating enough is, because we live in a culture where overeating is a big problem, and that's obvious. And we're in an abundant culture, and we have lots of refined carbohydrates, and we have lots of available quick access to calories, and we're not having to hunt our own food, and grocery stores are very easy and simple, and often social gatherings involve food. So overeating is obvious. Overeating is a common problem that, you know, I'm not surprised at all to see someone who's overeating. But I was a little bit surprised to see as high of an incidence of undereating as I do, and that's definitely in part related to cultural conditioning around image, and honestly, somewhat of an anorexic type of image for women in particular is unfortunately the cultural norm for what people consider sexy and attractive. So women see, of course, on TV and in media in various ways, women who are unhealthfully skinny as an ideal to look towards and compare themselves to in the mirror. And that's a big part of undereating. But another big part of undereating that was more surprising than that to me was that when people switch to paleo diet, to low carbohydrate diets of various kinds, it can actually be a little bit difficult to have adequate caloric intake. And I've experienced this myself. I've tested my own blood and found low leptin and high adiponectin, basically indicating that my body was overly hungry and insufficiently full. So as I eliminated refined carbohydrates and sugars and things, I found that I pushed my body into a hunger state. And so I see this now in my personal experience and not infrequently with people who are on a health journey and who are paying attention to health and who are trying to legitimately eat what seems like enough food. But it, especially with restricted carbohydrate intake, it can be sometimes easy for people to have insufficient overall amounts of food. And if you get an adiponectin level and or a leptin level, it can help you to assess and identify that. Adiponectin and leptin are hormones that indicate hunger level and satiety or full, how full people are, and from a hormonal perspective. So more common, you're going to see leptin levels elevated in people who are overeating and whose bodies are not registering the full signal, and that's a big, big problem. Elevated leptin is a whole lecture for another time, but it's a big, big problem if there's leptin resistance and chronic leptin elevation, and that encourages continued overeating and inflammation and all sorts of other problems. But low leptin is possible and does happen, and that is an indication that people are hungry and they're not maybe eating enough. And same is true for high adiponectin. So we want to watch out for people who have really good diets, who are paying attention to their food, to make sure that they're eating enough calories. So that is important, especially, you know, I really pay attention to nutrient density of food, and I really want to eat high nutrient dense foods, which means, you know, avoiding a lot of processed and refined carbohydrates. So in those cases, it can be a surprising amount of salad and meat and vegetables. Vegetables almost take as many calories to burn in the digestive process as carbohydrates that they provide for most of the fibrous kinds of vegetables. So we almost don't count those in considering caloric intake. And so, you know, it's good to make people aware of that, especially when we see signs like a high glycomark, a low LDH, and or high adiponectin or low leptin. She had a high sex hormone binding globulin. Sex hormone binding globulin binds to both testosterone and estrogen, but its preferential bind, it's more sensitive to or more attracted to testosterone. So the body will, you know, the sex hormone binding globulin elevation may be a compensatory mechanism to lower testosterone or lower estrogen or both, but it tends to preferentially lower testosterone to a greater degree than it does estrogen. So I haven't seen specific research on this, but I do believe theoretically it makes sense that if a person were to be having a lot of phytoestrogen and or xenoestrogen exposure in the environment, let's say from lots of plastics or from phytoestrogenic foods like soy and flax, if that pushed their estrogen levels to the point where their body was trying to compensate and get rid of it, maybe compounded by a gut infection where beta-glucuronidase enzyme, which normally helps to, which can inhibit the body's capacity to get estrogen out via the bile. We'll talk more about that in the hormones class. Then it may be that sex hormone binding globulin elevation could be a compensatory mechanism to attempt to lower estrogen levels, but testosterone may get lowered more because of sex hormone binding globulin's propensity to and preference for testosterone binding. So we frequently see a picture of high sex hormone binding globulin, low free testosterone. Another cause of high sex hormone binding globulin is oral contraceptives. So had a patient in last week, and she came in a few weeks before that, and she's a young woman, early 20s, and she's just started on oral contraceptives, and they are not for regulating menses. They are, in her case, for birth control. So she asked me what are the hormonal implications or potential risks of taking an oral contraceptive. And one of the first things that I say and that we see in research is sex hormone binding globulin elevation even years after discontinuing oral contraceptives. So we have many, many, many women, even young women, who we see high sex hormone binding globulin who have history of oral contraceptive use, even if they only used oral contraceptives for a few years, and even if they've been off for 10 years, 15 years now, we do still see persistent high sex hormone binding globulin, which of course then binds estrogen and testosterone, which of course then can worsen, especially symptoms of menopause when a woman goes through menopause. So we see this picture a lot. We see a lot of women who are going through menopause with high sex hormone binding globulin, who have had a history of oral contraceptives, who are getting worse symptoms than other women and are seeking support through herbals or bioidenticals. So lowering sex hormone binding globulin is possible. Research shows that nettles can help. So nettles, interestingly, even though they're commonly used for allergies and histamine, can also help reduce sex hormone binding globulin. So sometimes we'll use nettle tincture if hormone complaints are high on a person's list. So that high sex hormone binding globulin explains the low free testosterone. And so hormone problems weren't the top two complaints, but it was in the top list of five. So we are considering doing some things for regulating those hormone levels. Here is this same patient's Dutch adrenal test. And in particular, we're looking here at free cortisol. And we're seeing that free cortisol level is 79 for the 24-hour total. 79, of course, is less than that 80 low. So she's probably feeling fairly tired from this low cortisol if the feeling matches her symptoms. She does have a little bit of fatigue. However, the complaint of insomnia is much more prominent. So in this case, when we see a low free cortisol level, we have to also look at total metabolized and factor that in. So when we look here, we see DHEAS level is very low. So that indicates to us that there may be issues with DHEA that may be contributing to what little cortisol there is on the free side being a stronger having a stronger catabolic effect. And since metabolized cortisol total is upper middle of the range, we do see that the metabolized cortisol is not too high, but with that high free T3 and high thyroid hormone, we might expect it to be falsely elevated a little bit. So we're thinking that metabolized cortisol without the thyroid medication or without the over medication may go down a little bit. So in my thinking, I'm thinking, okay, total metabolized cortisol is probably low normal when we factor for the potential over medication of thyroid due to the free T3 being elevated that we saw. DHEAS is definitely low, and free cortisol, 24-hour free cortisol, is definitely low. Symptom picture, however, is sleep issues and some anxiety. So either the sleep issues are unrelated to cortisol and more related to either melatonin levels or the low blood sugar dropping low enough that cortisol levels are rising enough in the middle of the night, or it's related to another issue with the sympathetic side of the nervous system, more of the adrenaline side of the adrenals than the cortisol side of the adrenals. There are a variety of other, or the GABA system is out of check and there's anxiety. So there are a variety of considerations with a sleep issue that we're looking at here. And my thinking on this with this lab is that the cortisol levels don't explain it, but the low blood sugar might. And with the high glycemic and the dysglycemia, the low blood sugar potential may drop low enough in the middle of the night to push the cortisol to get high enough in the middle of the night to wake her. And if that wakes her, of course, then she's going to have difficulty sleeping. And if she doesn't sort of tune into that food might be, or low blood sugar might be part of the problem, and she doesn't have a little snack, then it could keep her up the rest of the night. So part of the prescription here is a protein snack before bed. However, we have SIBO as one thing, and we're trying to work on the migrating motor complex, and the best time for the migrating motor complex to do its thing is fasting overnight. So we have a little bit of a, we have to figure out what's more of the issue. Well, for her, sleep's more of the issue. So we're going to preferentially raise the priority level of sleep, and we're going to be willing to sacrifice a little bit of migrating motor complex activity in order to get the sleep, because the SIBO responded really well to treatment very quickly, and the insomnia has been more stubborn. It actually responded really well at first to some GABA L-theanine and taurine, and then it was better for a little while, but then it was worse again. So we're considering that being a problem as well. So we have a question: wouldn't berberines used for SIBO address some of the low blood sugar at night? Well, berberines actually are shown a little more in research to lower blood sugar versus raise it up at night. So if anything, berberines might be perpetuating or worsening low blood sugar at night when we're using them for the SIBO. So overall, her blood sugar isn't low, so I'm not too worried about berberines overall lowering blood sugar too much. But she does have these drops. So more what I'm concerned with is the stabilization of blood sugar than the overall level. So I'm okay if berberines lower the overall level a little bit. But what Glycomark tells us a little more is the valleys, the dips, are getting a little bit low to the point that might stimulate cortisol release. So I'm thinking more about fat, fiber, and protein in order to stabilize levels. But we also, with sleep, need to consider at night carbohydrate intake being a factor that we want to often people improve in their sleep from increasing the amount of carbohydrates at night. And if they have those carbohydrates together with fat, fiber, and protein, that'll help regulate blood sugar throughout the night. But we do want to consider whether there would be benefit from doing additional carbohydrate to what she's doing with the evening meal in order for the sleep effect. And that's something we find clinically, and that's something that that we sometimes see again with low carbohydrate diets, where someone might not be getting enough calories, which we do believe in this case is an issue, that the low carb and not getting enough calories may be one of the causes of the blood sugar drops and one of the causes of the sleep issue. And so by adding additional carbohydrates in general into the diet, but especially in that evening meal, with together with also doing fat, fiber, protein, and then adding protein and fat snack right before bed, is a good strategy given these labs and what we see so far with the adrenal picture, because adrenal and thyroid issues, as I mentioned earlier, often respond better to moderate carb than low carb, especially if it's healthy and good kinds of carbohydrates. So, that is the case, and those are the main considerations and ways that we've been thinking through this so that we can, you know, come up with some solutions for a challenging case. And like I said, the SIBO treatment responded super, super well and responded quickly. And the thyroid factor together with the low blood sugar factor are the next pieces that we're working and focusing on to get that sleep better. And the first layer of sleep was improved by taurine, and the mechanism for taurine is that taurine can bind to GABA and I believe glycine receptors in the brain, so it can stimulate GABA and it can help with glycine as well. So taurine at night is definitely something to give a try, and it can help, and it did in this case, but it didn't sort of do the lasting work that would be something that completely resolved it. So this is a case where then we did also some a variety of things. Interestingly, with SIBO, after we cleared the SIBO, which happened fairly quickly, and the bloating went away, and the constipation got much better. When we started her on Free the MMC, she was reactive to that, and so the migrating motor complex supplement, which we use, which uses herbals including ginger, is one of the primary herbals. She was noticing her sleep was worse, and so we stopped Free the MMC. And of course, Modal Pro is similar in that it heavily uses ginger, so we couldn't do Modal Pro, and we were considering Iberogast, although Emerson Ecologics, who used to carry Iberogast, stopped carrying Iberogast. So that is available, I believe, through other sources, but just a little bit more difficult to get since we have an account with Emerson already. And so in considering what to do for migrating motor complex, that's a little bit tricky in this case, because not only do we have this low blood sugar reaction, and the question of what happened with ginger, did it give her night sweats or how did she react? No, not night sweats. She is fairly sensitive to supplements, and she does, and sleep is her chief complaint. So she's always paying attention to her sleep when she starts a new supplement, and often she will, to not infrequently, she will react to a supplement. Doesn't make a lot of sense as to why she's reacting by not sleeping as well, but she does have reactions for not sleeping as well to a variety of supplements. And so the ginger, as far as I'm aware, did not give her night sweats, but she just did generally notice that she was not sleeping as well when she took it, and then when she slept better when she wasn't taking it. And to compound that issue for her with respect to preventing recurrence of SIBO and stimulating the migrating motor complex, to compound things, she has low blood sugar, and that low blood sugar may be impacting her sleep. So were encouraging her to have a protein snack before, or a protein fat snack before bed. And we know that that may impact the level of, or the time that she has for fasting, which of course is a trigger for the migrating motor complex. So it's a little bit of a sticky situation in terms of what to do. But again, because her insomnia is higher priority, because her insomnia is more pressing, more difficult of an issue, the SIBO responded a lot more easily, we're going to, what we're doing is we're favoring the insomnia treatment and the low blood sugar treatment over the SIBO migrating motor complex repair. But we're factoring it in, we're considering it, and we're still encouraging her to take time between breakfast and lunch and between lunch and dinner. But then because of the evening and the sleep is an issue, to have that snack in the evening and to eat more quantity in those three meals so that she can bring her overall carbohydrate level and overall calorie level up into something that we believe will help the adrenal status and regulating cortisol and help the thyroid status and also help the blood sugar and potentially help the sleep with relation to that blood sugar issue for the sleep. Now, we feel like there's also a GABA issue with sleep because of getting at least some temporary results from the supplementation of taurine. So we also have to consider, why are those GABA levels dysregulated? And we know there's a connection between GABA and certain probiotics in the gut. So with that vagal nerve connection, in addition to thinking supplements like taurine or liposomal GABA, we're also going to think indirectly in root cause, you know, from a root cause perspective, could there be some gut dysbiosis that might be contributing, and might probiotics and or prebiotics as tolerated now that the SIBO, the mild SIBO is reversed, that may be able to stimulate production of some of the probiotics that help stimulate the vagal nerve to increase GABA production. So there's that research study with mice looking at Lactobacillus rhamnosus supplementation in mice and increased GABA release during stress response. So we can think about Lactobacillus rhamnosus as a probiotic choice in this case, especially now that the overgrowth of SIBO has been eliminated. And we want to replenish that healthy flora anyway to, as part of our recurrence prevention strategy for SIBO. So we're still working on leaky gut repair for SIBO, and we're working on the probiotic prebiotic side of the post-SIBO protocol. But the MMC side, we're a little bit challenged on because of the dynamic going on. So that complexity within the context of this case has us prioritizing the dysglycemia. And we're hoping that as that dysglycemia corrects and as that adrenal status and thyroid status improves, that the sleep will get better and that the blood sugar will be better regulated, so that we can then move back in the direction of fasting for longer periods of time at night and stimulating the MMC, potentially go back to some supplements with the free the MMC, but we can also do some electrical stimulation acupuncture for helping to stimulate the migrating motor complex. And it's possible that doing some of the other additional stress management work might help the nervous system and indirectly help the migrating motor complex as well. So we're focusing with her on working on that GABA response and getting adequate GABA levels, and on regulating blood sugar as our two top focuses, that we're hoping to correct that dysglycemia and the insomnia we're having her with the high free T3, work with her prescriber on managing her medication levels. We're working not yet on the high sex hormone binding globulin, low testosterone, but we have sort of next on our list is hormone dysregulation stuff. So as some of this other stuff gets worked out and we drop off some supplements there, we'll add in nettles for high sex hormone binding globulin and a Chinese herbal formula that's geared towards hormone regulation. And so that will be helpful for when we're getting into the hormone. So this hopefully gives you an idea of how to prioritize and think through when to do one thing versus another in terms of being able to see multiple things going on, but have to choose which one to do first, and having to face the issue of supplement tolerance and having to, but the importance of getting enough information to be able to both listen to the client and their chief issues, as well as enough laboratory information to assess the thoughts about which root causes are going to be best and which order to address them in. So it's a really nice case to be able to talk about in that way. And you know, as I mentioned earlier, she's on that spectrum of fairly sensitive to supplements, and the insomnia gets triggered by fairly sensitive supplements. So the other thing that does come to mind in relation to that is a curiosity about liver detoxification, about LPS, for example, with some of the gut issues and some of the reactivity to supplements. And so that's something that, you know, we may consider with her doing a leaky gut testing and looking at LPS and or doing some liver detox supplementation to see if she can reduce in her sensitivity to supplements. And that may be a part of the picture as well that we haven't yet fully addressed. And, you know, we may have her on something related to liver detox, but I don't remember. I'd have to look through her chart to be absolutely sure. But that's definitely in my mind and on the list of things that I'm considering and thinking about for next steps in this case. And that may be a part of the hormone issue. So the gut, we'll see how much of the gut issue corrects the hormone stuff, but we're also going to be looking at and considering liver in relation to the hormone dysregulation and the blood sugar, of course. So hope this case has been super interesting for you and helpful in getting a picture of a complex case where multiple things are happening. And since we've been going over HPA axis stuff, we have a couple of these Dutch adrenal labs, so you can see how we're thinking about working with that. And one last thing to mention here is with this low DHEAS level, that's something really worth addressing, and that we are having her right away supplementing with DHEA. And then it's also, of course, very safe to do adaptogenic herbs in this case. And we did some of the sleep herbs, and like valerian, and she had a little bit of a reaction to the valerian, Sisyphus, and passion flower blend. So we started on that for a little while, but then stopped to that. But we will be looking at adaptogenic herbs that may be able to better bring up some of these cortisol levels and HPA status. And so that would be an adaptogenic herbal blend, something along the lines of Eleutherococcus or Siberian ginseng, maybe some Schizandra, which is a really nice, relaxing, calming herb. So that might be good in terms of the sleep issues. And actually, I take it back on the, Eleuthero and Schizandra. Ginseng, though, we did try a sleep formula and an adrenal formula with ginseng in it, but ginseng is another one that she was reactive to. And we mentioned that in our HPA section, that there are people who ginseng is stimulating for. That being said, traditionally and in Chinese medicine, ginseng is commonly used in sleep formulas. And we do see in research that stressed people do tend to have cortisol lower if there's increased amount of stress, but cortisol raise if cortisol is low. But in this case, and with some people, we just see that it's a little bit highly stimulating. And so we use it with caution with certain highly sensitive people, even though it's in a lot of sleep formulas and we actually do like it. And people do respond, several people do respond well to sleep formulas that have ginseng in it. We do have that caution. So in this case, when putting together an adaptogenic herbal formula, we will not be considering ginseng. We will be considering Eulerythrococcus, Schizandra. We'll be considering rhodiola, although again, a little bit of a caution in rhodiola just because of clinical experience. It tends to be calming mostly, but again, some people have a stimulatory type of effect from it. And so I would be a little bit cautious with her because of how sensitive she is with rhodiola and what I know about that. But I would definitely be considering Eulerythrococcus and Schizandra. And I'd also be considering Romania, licorice, and a few others. So those would be some of the adrenal considerations beyond the blood sugar status, which of course is one of the root causes behind adrenal dysregulation that we have to be considering. And aside from the potential for thyroid over-medication, which could be impacting the HPA axis as well. So those things are some of the main considerations with respect to adrenal glands. Of course, we also put her on magnesium and DHEA to help bring that DHEA level up, which, you know, may offset some of those late night cortisol impacts. And she did, when we put her on DHEA, because she's sensitive, she did have a little bit of a skin outbreak, so we had to reduce dose on DHEA. But when we took DHEA out after her skin reaction, she noticed she was significantly more fatigued again and during the day. And so DHEA was helping her, and she wanted to introduce it back in. So we introduced it back in at a lower dose and found a dose that worked for her. So she is on that spectrum of client where there's sort of a delicate balancing act, and there's going to be continual modifications and adjustments and fine tuning over time, and a lot of thought going into what to do and when, and which herbs that we might want to, you know, avoid, and which herbs we might want to emphasize. And so in her case, even though free cortisol is low, I would not consider glandulars as a go-to because of her sleep issue being so prime. So I would consider licorice, but not at night, and probably on waking or with breakfast, and maybe with lunch, but no later than lunch. And I would also be considering and I'm just going to switch programs here real quick. So I'm going to stop screen share and go over to a Word document so we can actually just go through the exercise of how we would think through doing a protocol. So here we go. You should be able to see the Word document here. And we're going to go for a table that is, we're going to go for the supplement, and then before breakfast, breakfast, before lunch, lunch, before dinner, dinner. And we'll have that many for now. We may insert a couple more. So this is where we're going to put supplement. Waking, breakfast, before lunch, lunch, dinner, bed. And sometimes I'll design supplement protocols in this way. Sometimes I'll just put two columns and put away from meals, with meals, and do it that way. But so in terms of thinking priorities here, and thinking number one is for her is sleep. We really want to be considering what are the root causes of sleep. So we've talked about GABA, we've talked about low blood sugar, and we've talked about gut. So in relation to the GABA, we know taurine helps her. That's an at bedtime 500 milligrams. And we can play between 500 milligrams and 1,000 since she's a little more sensitive, leaning towards the 500. We could go up to 3 grams of taurine a day, especially if there were also fat malabsorption. We might space it out in the day, and that would help with making bile acids. So it's sort of what helps the bile acid become the bile salt, actually. And so is glycine. And glycine, we also do like as to work with sleep issues, and it also works with the liver detox. So since she's as sensitive as she is, glycine is something that I would strongly be considering, and I haven't put her on it yet, but I've been considering it. So let's say glycine 1 gram as well, and since we're thinking about it also in relation to liver detox, let's also put another 500 milligrams at breakfast there. So this is going to, if there are gallbladder issues, she's not expressed gallbladder issues or fat digestive issues, but she's in that age range of high risk for gallbladder issues. So that's something that that may sort of act in a certain way as a preventive for preventing against gallbladder removal. And then in relation to sleep, it isn't a supplement, but we're going to just put protein/fat snack, and that's before bed. And I'm just going to put sort of also, I'm going to put for the treatment protocol, we want to do with dinner some carbs at this meal. So carbs at the dinner meal, be sure she's eating some healthy carbs there, and before bed, a protein fat snack. So then in relation to the we've covered with taurine some of the GABA relationship. If that doesn't seem sufficient in relation to GABA production, we can think then about the probiotic. And that gets both the GABA production and also the gut connection, the gut-brain connection. So probiotic, make sure it has, with lactobacillus rhamnosus. And we'll especially want that before bed. We might also add one on waking, and we might choose one with 100 billion. We might be thinking around 60 to 100 billion per day of mixed strains, but the mixed should include Lactobacillus rhamnosus, since we do see research directly with that and GABA levels. Then we'll be thinking, okay, so we've addressed a little bit of that that gut brain connection. We've addressed in two different ways the GABA connection, and we've also looked at that liver detox a little bit and the low blood sugar a little bit. So the other things that we're going to want to look at in more detail potentially are looking at the cortisol levels, adrenal dysregulation, any additional gut things. So with relation to the gut, we also want to heal up that leaky gut. Since we finished protocol for SIBO, we definitely want colostrum. Now, in this case, we do not want to give her glutamine. Now, glutamine is highly researched, as we all know, for leaky gut, and it can be super helpful. But in this case, we do not want to give her glutamine because she's got GABA issues potentially. And if she's got GABA issues, there's a likelihood that she may have difficulty with the enzyme that converts glutamate into GABA, and or an enzyme that clears glutamate from the body. And glutamate can be a neurotoxin and can be involved in sleep issues and neurologic issues. So even though we're dealing with leaky gut, in this case, we really want to avoid glutamine due to the sleep concern and due to the relationship with glutamate and GABA that glutamine can exacerbate. So regardless of whether we have 23andMe data, I'm going to avoid glutamine in this case. And just a clarification from a question about what gave us the indication of potential GABA issues. Well, yes, the sleep issues were in persistent and chronic sleep issues, we're definitely considering and thinking about GABA. And while we were doing testing, we started her on a taurine supplement, which impacts GABA status, and she improved. So the fact that she improved on taurine makes us consider that that may have been a GABA response that made her improve in that case. So that's making us think that GABA may be a big part of this case in relation to the sleep. So it could be just taurine, or we could give her liposomal GABA-L-theanine mix, for example, like Quicksilver's product or Allergy Research Group's product. So that's another option as well. But since we're kind of prioritizing here and trying to not make this supplement protocol, you know, too crazy large and not sort of face too much of supplement overload, we're going to be a little pickier and choosier. And this should help you to figure out what are the most important things and things you're going to rule out and sort through. So we've already talked here now about how the colostrum I'm going to favor for leaky gut, but I'm going to avoid the L-glutamine due to that sleep issue and GABA potentially being a concern in this case. So colostrum, we're going to do, most people do really good. We give colostrum as a powder usually. So most people do pretty good in the morning. So 2 scoops, and we might also add 1 scoop in the evening time. That's a pretty big dose. And that would be of, you know, 1 scoop being about a gram of IgGs. So this is about 3 grams of IgGs, and of course also the other constituents in colostrum are important as well. And then we're also going to want to consider for leaky gut some sort of spore-based probiotic. And that could be Megasporebiotic, or it could be Biospora, or it could be Prescriptocyst. But we'll think about two of those with a meal. Now, some people don't do well with doing things at all at lunch, so we might skip that and try to do twice a day supplementation. But if she does well with 3 times a day supplementation, which I believe she actually does, then we'll put it in the lunchtime slot here. So a spore-based probiotic can help prevent SIBO recurrence and help to correct the remaining leaky gut that is likely there and help with that gut-brain connection. So that's the thinking there. And then in relation to regulating cortisol levels without disrupting sleep, because cortisol is low, but the sleep issue may be due to a cortisol rise with consideration for that low blood sugar, we have to think carefully here, and adaptogenic herbs are probably a nice way because they can modulate and regulate and bring it up and down. So adaptogenic herbal formula. And we definitely want that to help wake her up in the mornings. This will be before breakfast. We'll have her take it depends on what the formula is, but a teaspoon if liquid, or maybe depending on how potent caps are, 2 to 4 caps. And then same thing at dinner time, before dinner time, or before bed. We have to be careful with the before bed to make sure she's responding well, but we try it there first to see if she is going to respond well and it helps her. But if it doesn't, we'll be moving that back towards lunch perhaps, or maybe with dinner. And then we're going to want to be considering the whether there's anything else here. We're getting towards 5, 6, 7, 8, or 8 supplements. So we want to think, okay, is there anything else important that we really should be doing for the gut and or for GABA and or for adrenal hormone regulation, in order to help regulate this case and get it, get her at a great point. So what I'm thinking here is sometimes vitamin B6 and or zinc. Zinc is helpful with leaky gut, and it can also be helpful in certain cases of anxiety and overactive thinking. And that, of course, can disrupt sleep. So zinc is definitely something I'm thinking about. And I'm also thinking a little bit about B6, because B6 also can be indicated in some cases of anxiety and insomnia. So I'm going to do Zinc Supreme, which is a Designs for Health product that has both zinc and vitamin B6 in it. And this is definitely important to take with food because it can cause nausea otherwise. So I'm going to do one with breakfast, one with dinner. And I want to be aware of if and whether she's taking other zinc, because that dose is going to be a little bit above what I'd do long term for someone, but for short term, that's a fine dose. It's about 60 milligrams of zinc, but for long term, I won't want to go any more than 40 is more the upper limit for long term safe dosage of zinc. So we'll want to reduce that down to 1 after a period of time once we get the zinc status back to normal. Best, of course, is if we have a serum zinc. Second best, if we don't have a serum zinc, if we can at least do a tally taste test and have someone do the little zinc water solution in their mouth and see if they taste the metallic taste and how quickly. We like the serum test better. We believe it's more accurate, but if you know we can't do that, or if there's too many other tests going on, then the tally test will at least give us a little bit of information. But we don't always see the tally test correlate with serum levels, so that is something to just know about as you're dosing. You're going to still want to educate people about high or toxicity signs, and higher dose zinc for a short period of time can be absolutely fantastic for gut issues, for leaky gut, for pyroluria, which is a condition involving anxiety and depression, or depression and maybe part of what perpetuates someone's mind to go at night. So these so zinc is a really nice addition here. We can't really do one of the most of the combo GI products with for leaky gut have glutamine in them. So in this case, we have to steer clear of those, but we can choose zinc. And in this case, I'm doing zinc supreme. We could also have chosen zinc carnosine, which could be helpful as well, or instead of zinc supreme. But I want the B6-2, so I'm looking at zinc supreme in this case. And then because there was also inflammation and back pain, even though it's not sort of necessarily directly top choice mechanistically for one of these issues, I am going to throw a Therachermin HP at a dose of 2 away from a meal. So we'll do that before lunch. And the reason I'm doing that, a Therachermin HP, is because I want to, you know what, we don't have anything else before lunch. If she doesn't have to take anything one time a day, that's pretty good. So we'll add it at bedtime here. And she's taking some of her other herbs. So the reason I'm adding that, she's got inflammation, she's got back pain. Therachermin can also help regulate cortisol levels, and so it's going to help with HPA axis activity. And it is also researched a little bit with the gut, and if there's brain inflammation contributing to the sleep issue, that could be helpful as well, because of potentially working with reducing inflammation in the brain. So that's my thinking on Therachermin HP. And then I really do want to make sure to use some magnesium. And in this case, even though there's not certain, even though there's not like a neurological condition in the sense of, Alzheimer's or dementia or migraines or something like that, I am going to probably try magnesium L3-innate, which I find, and I usually use a Cognimag, which is a pure encapsulation supplement that has that has the form of magnesium that crosses the blood-brain barrier. So magnesium L3-innate is the form that's been shown in research to cross the blood-brain barrier. Again, I don't know, but I'm imagining brain inflammation may be a part of the lack of sleep. So Cognimag is something that can get magnesium. I want some form of magnesium anyway. So Cognimag may help to cross the blood-brain barrier and reduce brain inflammation in addition to getting magnesium stores up. It's a more expensive way to go than other magnesium like magnesium glycinate. I might do a combination, and Cognimag is made by Pure Encapsulations. There's a question about fat absorption of Therachermin HP. Do you need to take fat with it? No, it's actually better to be taken away from meals, and it is a water-soluble form, so you do not need fat with it. It's water-soluble, so you just drink it with water, as you would need to anyway to swallow the pill, and it brings blood levels up higher than some of the other fat soluble forms that we've seen. So we like that for that reason. So with Cognimag, we may end up doing, and in fact we are with her doing a couple forms of magnesium, but we may do some Cognimag and then supplement with some magnesium glycinate. And if we supplement with enough magnesium glycinate, we could substitute that for glycine, because glycinate's going to take care of that glycine. So we could actually just put, you know, replace magnesium glycinate, and we could just say, and magnesium glycinate, I found, can make people nauseous away from food. So I'm not going to put it at bed. I'm going to put it with breakfast and dinner. And I'm going to put basically two to three caps, depending on the dose of which magnesium glycinate. So 300 milligrams and twice. So that gives 600 of magnesium. But then we're going to add the Cognimag, which is going to get a little bit more, but only maybe 144 milligrams per dose of two caps of the Cognimag. And we're going to do one in the AM and then one before bed, because the Cognimag I don't find so much to disrupt or to cause nausea. So that's one that we can do a little better with having at bed. So now we've eliminated one in favor for a different that's going to achieve that purpose plus another purpose. So here we go. This is a pretty good protocol. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 supplements and one food recommendation here. And, you know, we haven't done anything with melatonin here. So if this doesn't do us good enough on the sleep, we may be looking at melatonin. And of course, sleep hygiene, I talked to her all about that, and she's implementing that and enjoying that. Feels like it helps. But if we need to take that to the next level, we may be considering something in relation to melatonin, either 5-HTP, which actually she's already taking 5-HTP and she does notice it helps, or a sublingual or a liposomal form of magnesium, 1, 2, 3 milligrams at bedtime. So those would be other considerations if this doesn't work, but this is a pretty good protocol here, and it is likely to give some level of improvement, perhaps a full resolution over time as that leaky gut heals and that bacterial, the status of the gut ecology and gut microbiome improves, and then also as her blood sugar stabilizes from the dietary intervention and a little bit more carbs and getting a little more total calories and having that protein fat snack before bed. And then just because she is taking it already, and we did really want that DHEA in there, and she's sensitive, so we're doing the liquid drops, 1.2 milligrams per drop, and just, I believe she's on something like two twice a day, so she's on a fairly low dose of that because the higher dose did cause a skin reaction, but the going off it completely caused her to be more fatigued than when she was on it, so we will add that in, and might as well, because she's taking it, add in the 5-HTP. And she was overdoing the 5-HTP, so we brought her levels down to, I believe, 200 milligrams. I think she was at 300 or 400, which is a little bit high, especially for a long period of time. So we brought her levels of 5-HTP down a little bit. And we also, when someone's on 5-HTP for a long time as a serotonin precursor, we want to consider dopamine, and we may want to add, after a period of time, some tyrosine, which would help to, as a precursor to dopamine, and it also is part of thyroid hormones, so it may help it with both thyroid and with looking at the other side of the neurotransmitter equation to not get too off balance on that serotonin side for too long a period of time without considering the effects on dopamine. So we want to also consider with longer term 5-HTP supplementation that it's good to add in some tyrosine. But of course, in this case, first we want to make sure that her free T3 goes back into normal range and that she's managing the thyroid medication okay before giving things that might increase thyroid hormone. So that's something to be considering as well. And we have another question. Who makes the DHEA liquid? That is Biomatrix, is the name of the brand that we tend to use. And so Biomatrix. And like I said, it's 1.2 milligrams per drop. So this is a pretty small dose. It's 2.4 milligrams twice a day. So totaling a little under 5 milligrams for the full day. It is sublingual, so it's a little better absorbed. But it may actually, you know, this may have a hard time getting her blood levels up. But most important thing is that she feels good and she doesn't have that skin reaction. So we may gradually taper her up a little bit over time if her reactivity decreases. But if she's feeling really good, and then we might not want to mess with it and keep it at a low dose for a while. So we're indirectly, you know, we're addressing some of the other concerns as well that aren't as high of priority. The therocurmin HP is addressing some of the inflammation, and the hormones are going to be indirectly impacted by some of the adrenal stuff is, you know, potentially going to impact hormone levels as well as we clear up the gut. So it may be that this resolves everything. It may be that we need to go in later, add some nettles, and look at some other hormone formulas in order to get those hormones in check. But this is, as long as the SIBO doesn't recur, this is a pretty good protocol. We may have to switch gears if the SIBO does recur. And we do want to think also, if she stops reacting as severely to things and if the sleep gets substantially better, we do want to think a little bit about, okay, how are we going to regulate that migrating motor complex? And we have a question about retesting SIBO. Yes, she tested clear, and that was about 4 weeks between tests in this mild case. So it was pretty quick in being able to get to a clean SIBO test. So 4 weeks is probably the least that we'll ever do with someone before retesting. And we probably won't retest even in a mild case if they're still symptomatic after 4 weeks. But if they're not symptomatic and it was a mild case, then we'll often stop at 4 weeks and just say, okay, we're good. And let's retest and then progress on. So in this case, we were able to retest and progress on because symptoms did eliminate. In moderate to severe cases, we're rarely going to retest before 6 to 8 weeks, and we may add additional supplements. We may, instead of a 1 or 2 supplement protocol for SIBO, we may do a 3 or 4 supplement, or we may do 2 supplements for the first half for a month and then 2 different supplements for another month. So there are a variety of ways to mix things up in moderate to severe cases of SIBO. The spore-based probiotic will help to some degree prevent recurrence of SIBO because those spore-based probiotics secrete antimicrobial constituents, and then colostrum as lactoferrin, which is also antimicrobial. So that would also help with potentially decreasing SIBO recurrence. But we do have to definitely be considering that migrating motor complex route as something to realize that we're not necessarily directly dealing with in this case, and we may need to be thinking about the future of how to get that in check later on. All right, so this is a way to start to think about putting together a supplement protocol. Hopefully this helps you see more visually as we write down our thought process and how to prioritize things, how you might come up with a supplement protocol based on what you know about mechanisms of action that you've learned through this course and other materials that you've encountered, and starting to think about those root causes, but also branch treatment to getting people to reduce their symptoms while treating the root, and how to think about things from multiple perspectives. So not just thinking about GABA from the perspective of let's give liposomal GABA to someone who we think is GABA deficient, but thinking about, okay, taurine can stimulate GABA, but also that we can think about the gut-brain connection and the vagal nerve and GABA stimulation through lactorhamnosis and probiotics, and then also think about leaky gut but avoiding glutamine in relation to preventing worsening of GABA dysregulation and or glutamate dysregulation. So that's, you know, it's really great stuff to be able to be thinking about, and I really believe this will help you guys to think through that and be able to put together a protocol that's going to be really